Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. After the 6 o'clock news, it's a decade since the 7/7 London bombings of three tube trains and a number 30 bus, which left 52 dead, along with the four alleged suicide bombers Haseeb Hussain, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and Shahzad Tanweer from Leeds and Jermaine Lindsay from Aylesbury. The subsequent Terrorism Act means more wars abroad and less civil liberties at home. Terrorists have not taken those civil liberties away, the government have. A mass of evidence about the bombers and the bombings has come out since, which contradicts the official government version of events, but there's been no proper judicial inquiry which considers the possibility that those attacks were deliberately planned to get British public and politicians to support foreign wars and surveillance measures. Tonight we do a 10-year retrospective and take a look at some little-known facts to do with the 7/7, but with a special look at why many of the victims and families of the 52 that died feel they've been hung out to dry. Plus, as Saudi Arabia buys British bombs and uses British Tornado bombers to kill hundreds of innocent people and smash up the poorest country in the Arab world, Yemen. Plus, of course, a look at the Tunisia terror attack a week ago today. Plus, Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of any other world hotspots that he feels like. That's all in the second hour after 6 o'clock. On to our news review in a minute, but first Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 18 Celsius, feeling humid with possible showers. This weekend, highs 23, sunny spells with some possible showers on Sunday. Next week, highs of 23 Celsius again, plenty of sunshine with some showers. Next weekend, that's the 11th and 12th of July, highs of 23 Celsius and mainly sunny. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news, it's Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. Hi, Ron. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hello. Thank you.
Ron, can you just take us through some of the things that have been going on in your ward this week? Because I understand there's been some attempt, actually, by the Home Office to get one of the leaders of the Sikh community deported from Bristol.
Yes, I mean, he's the priest at the Chelsea Road site of the Gurdwara. But for 4.5 years, he was this Gurdwara leader in St. George West. He's a very educated person. He's multilingual. He's not a threat. He's a great community leader. He's got the full support of the Sikh community right across East Bristol. And he's given me copies of his previous applications to the Home Office. They amount to two pages of A4 with all the applications granted. And then suddenly out of the blue, there's some bureaucratic issue that needs to see him being threatened with eviction from Britain, and I think that is outrageous.
Well, you say outrageous, but surely he's got to stick to the rules.
Well, yes, yeah, stick to the rules, but stick to the rules by whom and who wrote them. I mean, he's not being accused of being a terrorist, as far as I know. I certainly know he's not got an AK-47 under the bed, and knowing him well, he is a man of peace. And what I think we've got here is a knee-jerk reaction by government bureaucrats that are just looking for any reason to deport people. And the fact that there was a hiatus with one piece of literature, which was the licensing of the temple, which has been sorted out and cleared by the Home Office, I cannot see any reason why he should be refused.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, this doesn't sound necessarily like British values, does it? We've been hearing this week about an extremism act. Now, this chap is not an extremist. Isn't it actually likely to fuel extremism when people like him are targeted?
Well, yes, is the simple answer to that. It may be that there was no suggestion in any case that this man's is being deported for his political activities, as I understand it.
No.
What I fear is that the government is pandering to the gallery here, or is it to the gutter, and they're trying to do as much as they can to try and make life difficult for certain communities in this country, and of course that will, in the end, have a very negative impact on the relations between the communities.
Okay, Ron, what is this chap's name, and what is his value to the community, do you think?
Well, I've got his name in the car, and I really don't want to get that out on air, because I think if you want to interview him, then you should invite him in and let him speak for himself.
But what's his value to the community? So it seems a little bit strange talking about someone when we're not talking about who they, you know, not giving their name. But anyway, what's his value to the community? What does he do?
Well, obviously, he leads their community and their religious faith, but he's also seen as their leader for the development of the Sikh culture amongst the young children in East Bristol. And he's also obviously the main target and focus for work in support of the Sikh community and the Gurdwara that he is in actually working for. And so, he is one of their senior leaders in East Bristol. And I just think it's a disgrace that the way in which he's been treated. And so what I'm doing, I know the cross-party MPs in the city are also alarmed and are trying to do something about it, but I intend to take a statement to the city council asking for cross-party support in keeping him here and supporting the work of the MPs, whether they're Tory or whatever they might be, even if they're not my party, because this is an injustice to a man of peace.
What is a Gurdwara?
Sorry?
The Sikhs have a Gurdwara. What is a Gurdwara?
Well, Gurdwara is the focus of the Sikh community, which has obviously got their temple and their ability to practice their religion. It's also a centre for the Sikh culture to be developed, and it's also a place where they come to meet on Sundays, and where they can actually feed members of their community, or indeed anybody else that's hungry within the area. If you were homeless and destitute and you go to a Sikh temple, they will not only give you food, they'll support you, and if necessary you could sleep there until you could find a place to live or sort your life out.
Now, Sikhism grew up in the 1500s and 1600s. What do you know about it, Martin, as a religion? I know they have one god as a sort of, a little bit like the Abrahamic faiths, but I just wonder what your knowledge is of the history and how Sikhism fits into the region. It's generally from, I think, Punjab area.
Yeah, well, it's Sikhism developed at about the same time as Protestant Christianity evolved in the West, and it was based on older ideas, but it was also influenced by Islam and Hinduism, and basically the main thing about Sikhism is the rebellion against the Hindu caste system, so that everybody is treated as equal. So yeah, They're very much a modern thinking religion, very, very much in that sort of spirit. And so they struggle to establish themselves, and they're not entirely pacifistic, but then which religions are ultimately?
No.
They have a unique contribution to international religious life.
Ron, what are your thoughts about why the Home Office are targeting him?
Well, I suppose what they've looked for is, if they want to make a statement, and if they picked on ordinary residents, it probably wouldn't be, on an individual basis, very newsworthy. But if they pick somebody of a particular standing and order in a community, one is a destabilising approach to it. But whether that's part of it, I don't know. That's only speculation. But I think it's the ability to try to make, if you like, with their newfound majority in Westminster, an impact somewhere and get themselves a name and show that they are doing something. But whether it's completely wrong and unjust, it's got nothing to do with it, because I'm afraid the government of the day are not sympathetic to people of this particular standing, or indeed working people either.
Martin, what's the significance of the Home Office singling out a spiritual leader of one of Bristol's biggest ethnic communities for deportation?
Well, we don't know, is a simple answer. It could be, and I hope it is, that it's just some bureaucrat trying to chuck their weight about, in which case it should be resolvable. Yeah. But if we are seeing, you know, an attempt to remove key individuals in certain communities as a way of trying to undermine community solidarity, then that would be very reprehensible. No doubt the government, even if they are doing that, wouldn't like to admit it.
No.
So let's just hope that it's a bureaucratic mess-up, and with enough people shouting foul, including, of course, if Charlotte Leslie, our Tory MP in Bristol, is prepared to speak up, that would be good.
Yes.
And maybe we can get this resolved in a positive way.
Well, if anyone wants to find out more, you can always contact Ron Stone. Ron, your number's on the Bristol City Council website, and you're quite an easy person. You have your own surgeries as well. People can come along and meet up with you on this particular subject. We'll definitely be following this one in the next few weeks to see how it goes, and also if we can find out the real reason why, if it's just a bureaucratic error or if there's something more sinister behind this. Anyway, on to some other news from the week, and I think we're going to have to start really not actually with what you might expect, which is the Greek failure for the Greeks to get their bailout, but the Chinese stock market's lost £1.5 trillion in the last 3 weeks. That's 10 times the size of Greece's annual GDP. Just to put this in perspective, says Zachary Davis Boran, that is today in the Independent, the Chinese stock market's endured a torrid 3 weeks in which it's lost value equivalent to £1.5 trillion. That's 10 times the size of the Greece GDP. Martin, actually, that is the same exact equivalent, pretty much, isn't it, of Britain's national debt. So what's the significance of that amount of money being wiped off the Greek stock market?
Not the Greek stock market.
The Chinese stock market.
Chinese stock market. Well, all over the world, in 2008, when the banking system crashed with the epicentre in the US, there were emergency measures taken, including in Britain, things like quantitative easing, etc. And the Chinese, as part of the international financial economic infrastructure, did their bit. They printed money, they tried to keep the economy floating along. And by doing that, of course, they allowed the world economy to carry on limping along. Whereas if everybody had followed the textbook market solution, which is to let the banks fail, then there would have been a crash which would have rebounded all around the world. The Chinese, of course, are intimately linked with us. You know, a lot of the stuff we buy comes from China. The Chinese, in fact, own the US national debt, effectively. And so what affects them affects us. And, of course, it isn't just Greece. Greece is symbolic of what's going on in Europe as a whole. What's happening in China is important. But there's every possibility now, as I've always stressed on this programme, that at some point the elastic is going to break somewhere. And, of course, it all happens at once. It could be that before the end of the year, we are really going to see the crash that we didn't quite see.
Well, do you know what, Martin? I don't think we will, because I think quantitative easing money is going to be pumped in if it looks like that there's going to be any problems in the Western markets.
Well, let me put that. I take your point, Tony, because one of the things Mario Draghi, who's the head of the European Central Bank, who is an ex-Goldman Sachs employee, if they can, whatever happens with the Greek vote, perhaps we can come to the Greek
vote. We will
vote
in a minute, yeah.
But whatever happens with that, there is going to be turbulence. And that will be the perfect point for Mario Draghi, who's an Italian Goldman Sachs guy, to turn round to the German government and say, we're going to have to print money now. Because up to now, the German government has resisted the European Central Bank printing money. In Britain and the US, we've just said print money.
I seem to remember around about Christmas time, the Germans caved in on that, and the European Central Bank announced that they were going to stop QE.
Yes, but the Germans have said, yes, a moderate amount can be printed, but they don't like it. It's like getting blood out of a stone to make them to agree to it. Now, some economists think that this is the main problem, that if the ECB just printed money like we do, and the Japanese do, and the Americans do, then that would solve the problem. So I can see that the crisis may go through another phase where the Greeks either do or do not exit the euro, but there's a euro crisis which then forces the Germans to print money to preserve the European banking system. Now that might, you see, the traders in the markets are betting on that. They think that when it push comes to shove, they will press the button. And of course, they're betting, therefore, that stock markets will go up. But it may well be, even if Greece leaves and all the rest of it, that Draghi won't get his way, and Merkel and Schäuble in Germany will not allow them to print money. The Bundesbank has been actually legally suing the ECB to stop them doing it. All of which suggests to me train wreck. And I can't see how anybody's going to avoid it. And of course, China going down at the same time,
isn't there an aspect to which the Chinese stock market going down is actually good for us over here, because it means that they are going to have to drop, in order to keep their trade going with China, they're going to have to drop their prices, which means we pay even less for Chinese goods.
Well, no, the problem is that if everybody crashes simultaneously, there's no demand in the world economy, and things like the Baltic Dry Index, which is the cost of shipping, have been falling for months. Meanwhile, stock markets all over the world have reached all-time highs. Now that cannot be right.
Just tell us a bit about the Baltic Dry Index and why that's significant.
The Baltic Dry Index is the cost of buying a ship to transport goods a certain amount of, a kilometre or whatever, and it's a very good indication of the level of international activity. When that goes up, things are moving along. Ships are coming into Portishead or wherever and disgorging goods and so on. When they're not, When that's going down, that means that real activity is going down. So in actual fact, the economy has been slowing down, despite all the global economy, despite all the money being chucked at it, but only, of course, chucked at the top. They haven't reflated the economy in the traditional way of raising wages and building infrastructure. The Chinese Communist Party made the same mistakes as in the West. They just chuck money at property, which is very good for some people, many of them Communist Party officials. So this is all coming to an end.
Well, according to worldcement.com, Martin, the Baltic Dry Index has really picked up in the last few weeks. It's had a very, very bad year, but it's picked up to a year-long high just over the last couple of weeks.
Well, all right, I've lost track of it in the last couple of weeks, Tony, but the point is clear. I do not think that the world economy is on the brink. I mean, if you look at the stock market values all over the world, we ought to be on the brink of a mega boom. Biggest stock markets ever. It's just not the case. And the actual fact, this is all the financial engineering, has made the stock markets completely divorced from the reality. And you can carry on pretending, it's like a cartoon character. As long as you don't look down, you can carry on making money. But at a certain point, they're going to look down and it's going to crash. And when it does, of course, talk about a long-term economic plan from the Muppets in charge here, will be seen for the nonsense that it actually is.
You're smiling there, Ron Stone, Labour councillor for St George West. What are your thoughts about the whole debacle with the Greeks? Because we've been hearing about this for years, the possibility that the Greeks might exit the euro. This week it actually happened, and Martin for years has been saying that we might have a whole house of cards go down when the Greeks default on their debts, but that hasn't happened this week. What's your thoughts about the whole politics of the money in Greece and whether it's right or wrong for them to have a referendum and exit the euro?
I'm no economist, but just looking at it from the outside, international capitalism and the way in which it functions or dysfunctions, I think is always aimed at the people at the top. And the problem with Greek situation is the people that are really suffering are the workers and the families in that area. And over the years, I mean, we're still trying to pay for the First World War, aren't we?
We just managed to pay it off last year.
Well, all right, but virtually, it took a long time. And so all countries run with deficits, etc. But my concern with not only the Greeks, but in another part of your news here, you've got European stock markets to slip in. And it seems to me that there's an indication of the ability to manipulate stock markets for the benefit of short-term gain. And the long-term effects go out the window. There's a suggestion of what they call short selling, which is trying to, if you like, manipulate the stock market and make money in the short term. What Martin was talking about, I think our government calls quantitative easing, isn't it?
Yeah.
About printing money.
Martin,
wish I could do that sometimes in some months, but I can't.
This is a big part of it, isn't it? The person, whoever it is, that has the right to print the money, that is to say the special drawing rights at the IMF and the European Central Bank printing its euros. The person who has the right to do that has a lot of power.
Well, effectively, it's been subcontracted to the private banking system. That's what's happened. In the 80s, Ron will remember, we were told that the government controlled the money supply and that they had to reduce the money supply, and inflation was always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, had nothing to do with anything else, and therefore they tried to control the money supply. But they deregulated the financial markets at the same time. So as the government squeezed back the amount of money it created, the financial markets created their own money, which made up for the money they'd squeezed down. And of course they then just gave up on trying to control the money supply, said it doesn't matter. And of course what they really wanted to do there was to break the trade unions in this country, to stop the what they call wage price spirals, the bad old days when people's wages used to rise in line with inflation, which were actually the good old days.
I can actually remember that, Martin.
There's Sunday, they're having their referendum. It's been said to be legal today, amazingly enough, by the courts. Well, I do wonder sometimes whether some of the Greek banks and the Greek courts are actually part of the problem. They're not really cooperating with the government. But anyway, they've said it is a legal referendum, which I find amazing that they would even challenge whether you're allowed to hold a referendum or not on something so important. And one of the things that's been talked about by some commentators is that round about 60% of young people are going to vote no. That's, in other words, to get out of the euro or vote no.
That's not the position, actually.
60% of young people voting no to the conditions of the IMF and the European Central Bank, and 60% of elderly people vote yes. It's a bit of a generational struggle. So you don't think that's the case?
Well, it may be the case. I mean, obviously, if you call a referendum with 10 days notice, it's going to be a bit of a call.
Anyway, it's on a bit of a knife edge. Any idea which way you think they'll vote on Sunday?
It's hard to say, isn't it? I think what Varoufakis and Tsipras have tried to do is that they've had to square a circle, which is that the Greek people, especially the bottom, the young and the poor, have had enough and they don't want to take any more. And don't forget that most of the money that Greece supposedly owes is money that was given to Greece to keep the rest of the banking system whole. So we're talking about Deutsche Bank and our banks. They got the money and the Greeks got the bill. And of course, what you should have done, if you're following the market textbook, is just let the banks collapse, which nobody was prepared to do. So then now it all becomes political. There is no economics in this anymore, because we made the decision to bail the banking system out in 2008. That means that it's government-to-government discussion now.
So
because we've decided that's what it wants to do.
If Greece votes yes on Sunday, in other words, they want to accept the deal with the IMF, then there'll be another general election in Greece.
Well, what will happen then is Schmidt, I think his name is, who's the head of the European Parliament, who's a German social democrat, but he doesn't sound very social democrat to me. He's saying, well, we will have to have a technocrat to run the country like we've had elsewhere, so that we can get on with,
That means Goldman Sachs, is it?
That means Goldman Sachs, yeah. So in other words, what they're attempting to do here is basically crush this upstart government in Greece, and they have to do that because if they do get a better deal, then Podemos in Spain, the left in Italy, and Sinn Féin in Ireland are all going to be coming back as they get their electoral bandwagons rolling, saying we want the same deal as them. And of course, this can't be allowed. We should have been restructuring everybody's debts years ago, but we haven't done it. The people who are owed money by Greece are insisting that they get 100% of what they're owed. 100% when they took a punt on something, and they've been making money all the way on it, and now of course they want 100% back, and they they've got to have 100% back because the banks are insolvent. They've always been insolvent. If you went through the books properly, you would find that the private banking system is bust. It was bust in 2008. It's still bust today, but they're carrying on pretending that they're not, but they have to carry on rolling over. The real key thing is if they admit there is a default. That word default, because it's a legal term. Once that term has been admitted, then all of these credit derivatives come into play. And all of these people then turned and said, well, we bet that they would default, now pay us the money.
So is it possible that there are people who will be betting on the Greeks defaulting?
Of course.
Is this the part of the casino?
This is the whole point. There's loads of people who bet on this. So they then turn up, say to the people, right, they've defaulted now we want our money. But of course, the people who bet on the other side of that haven't got the money. because the derivatives market is at least 10 and probably more times bigger than the world economy.
Okay, well,
it shouldn't exist, but it was created by the deregulation of the financial markets in the 1980s. Absolutely disastrous, silly policy. But there we are.
But it's good for the gamblers, obviously. Greek crisis live, says the Telegraph. Greek banks will run out of euros on Monday morning.
Well, this is, you know, they didn't have to do this. They could have said, we will carry on supplying you with the money you need to keep going while you have your referendum, and then we'll talk to you. But what's happened is that the Greek Central Bank has had its chain pulled by the ECB, so they're deliberately, Ambrose Evans-Pritchard in the Telegraph, it was saying, this is ridiculous, they're deliberately crashing the Greek banking system as a way of getting rid of the Syriza government. And of course, now the Greeks, the Greeks have got a choice here. Either they accept that they're too weak to fight and that they've just got to knuckle under, or they get defiant. And I think anybody who knows anything about Greek history and their response to German occupation and a military government imposed by the West, and this is another thing people have forgotten about this, Greece has not got a single penny of reparations from Germany for what happened in World War II, even though the whole Greek treasury was purloined by the Nazis. So the Greeks, in actual fact, are owed a lot of money by the German government.
But that was their choice. They forgave that debt, didn't they?
No, they didn't. They've now resurrected it. They chose to ignore it. The other thing, of course, is that there was a military dictatorship in Greece, and Greece was part of NATO at the time, so their chaps being trained at Sandhurst to fight the Russians. Military dictatorship killed hundreds and thousands of their people, and no compensation for that either. So who owes who what is a very interesting question. Germany has defaulted four times on its international debt in the 20th century. Defaults can happen.
European stock markets, Martin, also slipping today.
Well, not surprisingly, because the whole game of cards is coming to an end.
The DAX, Frankfurt's DAX, lost just 0.1%, but there's just nothing big here. Are you saying that any kind of big fallout, crash, whatever, might be further down the line? In which case, how is this referendum going to affect that?
Well, it's hard to... I mean, how it will affect the markets is anybody's guess. But what will happen...
Well, let's take it... Look, first, if the Greeks vote no, that they don't want to have a deal with the... And go back to the drachma, effectively.
No, you've got that wrong, Tony. The position of the Greek government is that they're not leaving the euro or the European Union under any circumstances. And there is, in fact, no legal basis for removing them from either. They're saying, we don't just want to change the policy for Greece, we want to change the policy for the whole of Europe. So you in Ireland, you in Scotland, you in Spain, watch us, because we're going to change the policy for everybody.
But the City of London and the German Deutsche Bank are not going to accept that, are they?
No, they're not. And they may. But what the Syriza government has done is they've actually, very cleverly, the Communist Party in Greece, which is fairly substantial, is not supporting the Syriza government because they think they're going to sell out. So the Syriza were forced to, or not forced, they made an alliance with the Independent Greek Party, who is the Greek version of UKIP. Okay? Yes, but the Greek version of UKIP, yeah? And they've got the military ministry, okay? So they're the defence ministry. And right. That is to neutralise the Greek army as a potential political player. The real hostility to the new government doesn't come from the army, it comes from the police, who are infiltrated heavily by Golden Dawn, who are the fascists, who are to the right of the Independent Greeks. Now, the Independent Greeks are basically a right-of-centre party, but they're also nationalistic and therefore hostile to German bullying and so on. The Golden Dawn are outright Nazis, but I have to tell you this, the Golden Dawn people are all going to vote no.
Yeah. Okay, so what's your prediction for this time next week then, Martin?
I think they're going to vote no.
And what will that mean for markets around the world?
Well, the markets will have a panic, but then what Varoufakis would say, well, no, we should have, you should have been talking to us sensibly before this. We tried to avoid a panic. You tried to bully us. Now you've got to negotiate. But of course, what the Greeks are trying to do is overturn the whole policy, not just for Greece, but for everybody. And of course, that's when you go first on a mission like that, you've got to take the machine gun fire.
Well, let's hope they do well, whatever they're planning to do, because I think there's a lot of people around, particularly around Southern Europe, Portugal, Spain, places like that, that really want to see an end to austerity.
Well, there's a lot of people here as well.
Nearly fourfold increase in homeless families in Bristol since the government welfare reforms. That's in today's Bristol Post. The cost of providing emergency accommodation for homeless families in Bristol has doubled in just 12 months, Ron.
Yes. And I'm not surprised. If you look at my ward, for example, It's come out as the highest increase, percentage increase, in the cost of an average three-bedroom house. It went up 17% in a year. If you look at the impact of the bedroom tax in relation to people being evicted across the UK, in Bristol we've managed to keep a no evictions policy against George Ferguson's best advice, I'm happy to say, because I led that, and we've been able to protect some of the families. But with house prices going up to that degree, we've also got a problem in the rental sector, which is totally unfair and being manipulated, and people are finding it more and more difficult. And so there are more and more people, with the austerity measures and the job losses that we've had locally in some of the big retail outlets, etc., and the closures, that there are more people in serious debt, or indeed in serious danger of either losing their home or being made homeless. And so I'm not surprised at all. And it's a very sad position to be in. But we are planning, as a Labour Party, to use the mayoral election to highlight homelessness and indeed the way forward.
So that's another year before this gets dealt with?
Yeah, I know that. But in relation to the build-up and the campaign, there's the ability to change and alter some of the approaches the City Council makes.
Okay, so what could George be
things in place?
What could
now
the Mayor George Ferguson be doing right this minute to do something? What could the Mayor George Ferguson be doing right this minute to do something about
could,
this?
He could tomorrow allow the building of prefabricated eco homes on 85 sites in the city boundary. He could create a Bristol bond.
Financed by what?
Sorry?
Financed by what?
This is what I'm going to explain
to
you.
Okay.
Right? Create a Bristol bond for anybody to put their money into what is basically like the old national savings structure. And we could collate that money together with investment from pension funds to actually build these homes and top slice some of the rent and give that back as an increased percentage, better than market rates, to both the pension fund to top up the pensions and to give the investors, the private savers, the same percentage increase. We could do that now. And the other thing you should be doing and isn't is shouting very loudly, and I'm glad to see Andy Burnham has come out at least in recognition of this, that the capping arrangements on local authorities to use the public loan board to actually start building capital programmes, he's saying that he would lift it, and there is a whole UK-wide LGIU and other organisations, all councils are asking for this because every city has a major housing crisis.
Okay, before we hear Martin's reaction to the news about the homelessness, we're going to hear a little clip from Prime Minister's questions. And Brian Stewart asked a question on Wednesday of David Cameron about the way schools are funded across the country.
Yeah! Mr. Graham Stewart!
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Yesterday, the National Audit Office called for the introduction of a fairer schools funding formula so that it, and I quote, is related more closely to pupils' needs and less affected by where they live. Now, can the Prime Minister confirm today from the dispatch box that the additional and very welcome £390 million awarded last year as a first step towards a fairer funding system will be incorporated into the baseline for future years?
Well, I can say that we will implement the pledges in our manifesto on this issue because we do need to make funding fairer across the country. And if you look at the figures today, it is clearly unfair that a school in one part of the country can receive over 50% more funding than an identical school in another part of the country. So we've already made some progress on this, but I want us to go further.
Well, I find this rather amusing, because the whole thrust of Tory policy has always been to fragment the school system, to reduce it to its to small pieces, and the funding formula has just become incredibly complex. Think of free schools and academies that have been set up and then collapsed because they didn't have enough people on the rolls. I mean, my dad used to be a head teacher, and what he pointed out years ago was that if you don't actually make a plan, depending on the demographics of your society, then it's the most expensive way to do it.
Hang on a minute, because people want to be able to choose where they send their children to a variety of different local schools.
Yes, but that's not the cheap way to do it. Okay, and then you do end up with anomalies then, where some people get an awful lot more money than other people, and in actual fact, that suits some people very well, because they're the ones who get their kids into the schools, who get the extra help and all the rest of it. I mean, that's the real catch of many free schools, is we're going to exclude all of these troublesome kids, and we're just going to have our own kids in there, and that's basically the policy. That's what the policy has been, and it's not fair, it's not right. But the other thing is, it's not cheap either. We're supposed to have no money for anything. We're all tightening our belts. We're going to have austerity forever. But when it comes to pet projects like universal credit or free schools, well, money's no object for that.
Okay, what about the homeless story then, going back slightly? A fourfold increase in homeless families in Bristol since the welfare reforms 3 or 4 years ago. And just in a year, the number of families homeless has doubled.
Well, everything they've done in the 5 years they've had in power has made the housing crisis worse. And then in their manifesto, they said that they're going to allow, or they're going to force housing associations, which are supposedly independent organisations, they're going to tell them what to do with their own assets, and they're going to have to sell off to their tenants the best of their stock. Now, maybe Ron can help me out here, because I understand that the housing associations will then expect to be compensated by the local authorities, won't they?
Yes.
And the local authorities will have to sell off their best housing stock to compensate the housing associations.
Yes, and there's about a £7 billion hole.
Yeah, so they haven't even costed it.
No.
And of course, all this is doing is throwing more myths on the bonfire of our typical Tory property boom, in which they all make out like bandits. But of course, like there have been four Tory property booms in my lifetime. I don't know how many you've seen, Ron, but they always end the same in crash and disaster. And this one will too.
Reports today of inmates staging a sit-down protest at Horfield Prison over the way they've been treated in the Bristol Post, because it hasn't been printed yet, I don't imagine. It's on their website. Prisoners of HMP Horfield are said to be staging a protest about conditions. According to a report, some 30 of the inmates at the prison are sat outside and refusing to move. I don't imagine that's outside the prison. Police are said to be at the prison in a precautionary measure. Passers-by have heard shouts of "We shall not be moved" coming from over the wall. One inmate, who didn't want to be named, called the Bristol Post from inside, and said problems had started this morning after objects were being thrown over the prison walls near to the primary schools. Police are everywhere and the situation's not good, he said. Ron, do you want to start on this one?
Well, I mean, obviously I haven't read this, but I was aware that there was a problem in relation to the proximity of the school and the children, in relation to objects of whatever content being lobbed over the wall, and some of it didn't make it and ended up in the playground. I think the prison service at one stage it's been privatised to such an extent that it's very difficult to know what regimes are actually going on, and indeed to what level, if you like, restraint or other issues, how they deal with maybe people.
You're talking about packages. A couple of weeks ago in the Bristol Post, drugs were found in a Bristol school playground after a failed attempt to throw them over the wall of the prison. But Martin, we've got a wider problem here, haven't we? I mean, I know anecdotally several people who have been either working in or know people working in Britain's prisons who have decided actually it's not safe to work in there anymore. And we've had, actually, I think, just announced today, a death of somebody in Woburn who was escorting a prisoner from a prison van to jail.
Well, if we had somebody on a show from the Prison Officers Association, they would basically tell you, like many other public servants, we are underpaid and undermanned. We haven't got the resources to do what you're asking us to do. And of course, the whole, you know, why do we put all these people in prison anyway for non-violent offences? We could go into all of that. But, you know, the prison service is basically, you know, privatisation allows private entrepreneurs to make money out of other people's misery.
And they cut staff.
Yeah, and the way they do it is by making sure that they're not actually there to do the job, they're there to make money. And the idea that, in any case, when I remember talking to somebody from Denmark years ago saying, so you allow private companies to run prisons? I said, yeah. So that's nuts. And in the US, there was even a judge who was sent to prison himself because he had a share in a juvenile offenders institution, and he sent loads of juveniles there because that was that's what he needed to do if he wanted to get his pension.
Nick Hardwick, Chief Inspector of Prisons, in a recent report on Pentonville Prison in London, he said it was suffering from a failure of management and leadership. Other findings in his 120-page report included filthy lavatories, piles of rubbish on the ground, severe staff shortages, and a prisoner's shower unit, which was being used as a smoking room. Staff could not be bothered, didn't have time to wipe bloodstains off the floor.
Well, that's the whole point, isn't it? You've got to have, even if in the public sector, you've got to have the resources to do the job that you want to do. And of course, the private sector, by definition, is looking to cut costs and corners. And that's what you might expect. And of course, one of the problems with prisons is that nobody's got a real brief to defend the people in them or the institutions. People just want it to go away, so it's always a kind of Cinderella service. We can't allow things like this to carry on. The situations like this have got to be dealt with, haven't they?
Okay, well, we can't get him on this show. Tried several times. Well, probably about 20 times, actually. Jack Lopresti, we got him on for half an hour once. But he did pop up at Prime Minister's Questions on Wednesday with a question about the NATO alliance and the United States and how much money we're spending here on defence.
Jack Lopresti!
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Does the Prime Minister feel comfortable that a Conservative government has implemented a spending target on foreign aid, but will not commit to a target of a minimum of 2% of GDP on defence? And does he realise that this is damaging the relationship with our key strategic ally, the United States, and risking our credibility with our NATO allies?
Yes. What I want to say to my honourable friend, who I know cares deeply about this issue and also has in his constituency some of the most important defence manufacturers in our country, is that we have in every year met that 2% target. And that's in a European Union where many countries don't even meet a 1% amount for investing in defence. The commitment we've made already is to invest £160 billion across 10 years into our equipment programme with real terms increases every year. And that is why we can say the aircraft carriers, the C-17s, the new aeroplanes, all will be coming forward. We will obviously make final spending decisions in the spending review this autumn.
Well, the US have plucked this 2% of GDP out of their backside, frankly, and said everybody's got to spend 2% of their GDP, otherwise they're not in their gang. And you know what? People like me and people like Syriza in Greece, they don't want to be part of your gang anymore. And if they're going to spend 2% on defence, as they may have to do in Greece, it'll be to defend themselves against NATO-led military coups like the one they had in 1967 in Greece, which then put people there under the cosh until 1972. The idea that the more we spend on defence, the more we are defended, is delusionary. In actual fact, NATO, in many parts of the world, think Libya, think Syria, is the problem, not the solution.
But Ron Stone, the point really being made by Jack Lopresti there is the government have promised how much they're going to spend on international development aid, but they won't say how much they're going to spend on defence.
Well, no. What I think about this, and listening to those comments, we may be building aircraft carriers, but the last time we built them, as I understood it, we didn't have any planes to put on them.
Quite.
Right? So that seems a bit strange. I'm not quite sure what role that ship would take then in any form of conflict. The other thing that concerns me is the procurement process in the defence industry, because I understand, and unless I'm being misled, that there's a likelihood that this is going to be an Americanized company.
They're going to privatize it.
And if that's true, I question when we are looking to spend whatever we do spend on whatever arms or planes, ships or whatever, engines, whatever you like, will Britain and the workers in Jack Lepresti's constituency get a fair crack, or is it going to be biased towards Americanizing the whole of the arms industry and the military in Britain? Because I think that's a very serious danger. I don't know what Martin thinks.
Well, I think that is a serious danger. And I think also, just from a military point of view, do we really need an aircraft carrier? What are we going to do with it, even if it had planes on it? Would that have stopped the shootings in Tunisia on Friday?
No.
No, it wouldn't. And I would argue that in actual fact, I was an aid worker in Bosnia and I had to work with the British Army in Bosnia as a UN protection force. And I would suggest that that is far more likely to be the role of our forces going forward than a major conflict with Russia or China. But of course, that's not what they think in America. In the United States of America, across the board, they want a war with China and Russia. They talk about it openly. And we are being told to get our kit on and join in this mad crusade. And it's time. I mean, it's very difficult with a first-past-the-post system for these genuine views to come out. But across the spread of British opinion, you'll find that in Ireland, people don't want to be part of NATO at all. They've never wanted to be part of it.
Okay.
NATO is an organisation that's passed its sell-by date and is actually a menace in many parts of the world, as I've suggested to you. Now, I know this isn't the review of the Labour leadership, but it's my view.
On to another story, and Hatfield Colliery closure is speeding up the UK exit from deep coal mining. Now, this is an employee-owned pit, and it was brought up again at Prime Minister's Questions this week.
Mr. Dennis Skinner. For a man who seemingly is never away from Europe, why is it that he's never took the opportunity when he's been there to put in a claim for state aid to save British miners' jobs? He's the man who, during the election campaign, masqueraded as the workers' champion, and he hasn't got the guts to help those miners. He took £700 million out of the mine workers' pension scheme, and he's not given a penny back.
Very good to see the Labour Party in full voice cheering on Jurassic Park. I would stick to the movie. But there's a serious point here. This government has offered £20 million to the owners of Hatfield Colliery to keep that colliery going. So we have been prepared to put forward money, and unlike the last government, we've been prepared to make ministerial directions, because we've got some courage when it comes to these things.
But nevertheless, it does look like that pit is going to close. The Prospect Union, which represents workers there, says, in fact, their negotiator Mike McDonald said Hatfield has been unable to sell its coal because of the government refusal to sponsor coal contracts with generators, the doubling of the UK's carbon tax, Martin.
Well, the actual economics of this particular pit, I'm not aware of, so it's very hard to make a call on it. But in actual fact,
it's to do with the carbon tax, effectively. What they're saying is the carbon tax, which charges power producers for each tonne of carbon dioxide they emit, doubled to £18 per tonne to encourage utilities to switch fuels.
The real problem is that we used to dig virtually all of our own coal in Britain. But after the miners' strike, we are actually importing coal, particularly from places like Colombia.
And Russia and the US, apparently, the coal's now coming.
Now, in other words, if you're going to have we're going to run carbon down because we're trying to reduce carbon emissions, which there's a broad consensus about that, then you don't say, but we're going to buy the cheapest coal we can get from anywhere. What you do is you say, right, well, we're going to buy coal from our own people at a price which is reflective of our measurement of it in terms of carbon emissions and so on. They don't bother about carbon emissions in the Carajás mine in Colombia, because we had some of their guys over here, because the trade unions in Colombia are constantly being attacked. It's a huge open cast pit.
Shot.
Yeah. It's a huge open cast pit. It's the biggest hole on Earth. It's a hole 9 miles wide. And they work in these conditions. It's all very mechanised and everything.
This has come at the same time as the fracking proposals have been turned down, haven't they, Lancashire?
But in the Carajás pit, the local indigenous communities who've been farming this area were all driven off in order to make this pit. And the miners who work in the pit now are trying to fight for compensation for the people that were driven off, who are living in miserable conditions not very far away. Now, those are the kind of, that's the coal that comes in from outside. I mean, coal miners in China, hundreds, thousands of them die every year, even now, in private sector mines in China. Now, ultimately, the British mining industry was a jewel of safety. And we shouldn't be buying coal with blood all over it, whatever we're doing about carbon
Ron,
taxes.
Britain's remaining deep mines, Kellingley in North Yorkshire and Thoresby in Nottinghamshire, owned by UK Coal, are due to close later this year.
Sorry, what was that?
There's two other deep mine coals pits due to close later this year. Is this a sort of dinosaur industry that's time has come?
Well, no, not to a degree, because
actually, a lot of Bristol and Somerset was a lot of mining, coal mining
well,
around
my
here, wasn't
ward
there?
Has got coal seams under it, and we still got the old mining entrances, etc. that collapse occasionally. But what I'm basically trying to say is that we should be, if we're going to have coal, we should be producing our own. There are stocks and resources that, even after the miners' strike, there was new high-quality, very high-good anthracite field in the Swansea Bay, and it's never been used, and that's the sort of thing they use with the steel industry. And we get to a point where those communities that have built their self around a certain industry are absolutely decimated. The problem is, of course, is that the bulk of the government are not concerned about those industries, because they don't necessarily vote Tory. And I understand that we're trying to reduce carbon emissions, but on that basis, the destruction of, what was it, Didcot Power Station about 18 months ago, something like that. There is a reduction going on, but there should be the recognition and the rehabilitation of communities that built it on it. And finally, I have some contacts in Richmond, Virginia, and I understand that in part of Richmond, Virginia, virtually the whole of the top of one mountain's disappeared now, on the basis of open cast mining, which I think is what Martin was on about.
Yeah.
Okay, a couple more stories to do before the news at 6. Legal aid cuts, lawyers to begin boycott that could see courts grinding to a halt. Barristers and solicitors across the UK support direct action, arguing cuts will lead to miscarriages of justice and a drop in quality of representation. Grinding to a halt from Wednesday next week, possibly, Martin, courts.
Well, we've had people on this show who've been questioning this, have we not? And again, it's undermining the quality of justice available to underprivileged people.
This isn't the trade unions. They've mass meetings they're talking about here of solicitors and barristers.
Well, they are defending themselves, if you like, but they're also defending their clients.
Yes.
And that is the point. And if you've got to give people a fair go when they go to court. And, if you're not going to pay legal aid, then that's not going to happen, is it?
They're talking about boycotts, Ron. So what does this mean for justice here in Britain?
Well, I'm very concerned about justice, because only this week I was dealing with a local case of fraud, where a couple were defrauded by a person. They are being made bankrupt, and the legal process has treated them as the criminals when they have been innocent. They remortgaged their house to a tune of £300,000, and they've never seen a shade or penny of that money back. And the guy that ran off with the money has got off scot-free, whereas they were in court last week, and at lunchtime the usher told them to go home. They did, and in their absence they were tried. How's that justice?
They're also saying that people will be turning up for court with no solicitors there.
Sorry?
They will be unrepresented in court next week.
Yes. And it's totally wrong. And it's, again, it's an attack on the people at the bottom, that when they get into trouble, lawyers' fees are not exactly cheap. And the ability to get legal aid is, if you like, the price of justice. And clearly the Tory government couldn't care less about it.
Martin, overall, it's not usual to see. I mean, I think when we had a representative from Bristol solicitors and lawyers here about 18 months ago, he was saying this is the first time we've ever done this.
Well, indeed. I think that the professionals in every sphere, whether it's prison officers, as we were discussing earlier, lawyers, teachers, doctors, they are not going to stand for the government's slash and burn approach to everything. That because they've got an overall majority now, they are actually they've got their tails up, and the whole strategy, as put out in Naomi Klein's book, The Shock Doctrine, is to try and push as much through as possible, as quickly as possible, to shake everything up. So they're going to try and kick 10 tons of whatever out of everybody.
Okay, time for the Murdoch News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, Labour Councillor for St George West, Ron Stone. After the Murdoch News, it's a decade since the 7/7 London bombings.
BCFM is an award-winning community radio station for Bristol, bringing you national news on the hour, live from the Sky News Centre.
From the Sky News Centre at 6, millions of people have marked a minute's silence for the victims of last Friday's gun attack in Tunisia, killing 38 people. It was observed at sporting events including Wimbledon and the British Grand Prix, while the Queen and David Cameron paid their own respects. 8 more bodies of British victims have been flown back home this afternoon, including those of Eileen Swanick and her partner John Welsh. These people, who attended a memorial service for them in Wiltshire, knew John.
Anything happened to you in the middle of the night, you broke down or whatever, John, give him a call, he would come and help you.
He was a man that would avoid confrontation at all costs, and to have such a violent end is just hard to bear.
The mother of a suspected armed robber who was shot dead by a police marksman 10 years ago says she accepts a jury's decision to clear him of murder. Anthony Longs always insisted he open fire on Azel Rodney in North London to protect his colleagues. There are reports police in Athens have clashed with protesters, with rallies taking place in the Greek capital ahead of Sunday's bailout referendum. The country's prime minister is still pushing for people to vote no to the deal. The firm employing a female prison officer who's died following an alleged assault at a court in London says it will work to prevent similar incidents in future. Lorraine Barwell was 54. In sport, Britain's Heather Watson's battling against Serena Williams in the third round at Wimbledon. Live now to Richard Newman, who's on centre court.
And it's the toughest battle of Watson's tennis career so far. She lost the first set 6-2 to the 5-time Wimbledon singles champion, but the British number one is a fighter. She's broken Williams in the second set. Watson serving now 3-2 up, but 40-15 down, 15-40 down on her serve. The centre court crowd are fully behind Watson, even Australian fans orchestrating songs for her. Comfortable wins today for Djokovic and Sharapova.
And a plane powered only by the sun has completed a record-breaking journey across the Pacific Ocean. Solar Impulse 2, as it's called, touched down in Hawaii an hour ago, having flown non-stop from Japan. Well, that's the latest. I'm Joe Davies.